anyone.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. What a special, fun, impromptu little show that we've done here. I appreciate that.
Very fun. Aww. Love having you. Come back anytime.
Oh, shucks.
Bye, guys. Bye. See you soon.
Slice of Life Art and Gift Shop is Vancouver's choicest destination for one-of-a-kind artist-made prints, posters, screen prints, riso prints, paintings, acrylic paintings, watercolor paintings, ceramic mugs, ceramic plates, ceramic bowls, ceramic pots, lapel pins, hats, toques, crochet bathing suits, jewelry, trinkets, knickknacks, hand-painted signs, curated thrift, and a bunch more stuff that won't fit in this designated block of airtime. Slice of Life Art and Gift Shop, located at 1636 Venables, just off Commercial. Open 11 to 6, 6 days a week.
Old or New Testament?
I think the New Testament.
The question is, Pilate. Remember Pilate from the New Testament?
What does Pilate? He fiddled while...
Yeah, no, well, just a minute. Let me ask the question, then you can give me the answer, okay? Did Pilate want Jesus to be crucified?
Pontius Pilate washed his hands of it.
So did he want him to be crucified?
Yeah.
No. No. No.
Well, tune in every Friday afternoon, 3:30 to the Nightwatch Show on Xenia!
Well, find a good church. It'll help you out.
Let's see here, World of Warcraft, God. Ugh.
Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance.
Ugh. Everybody. God, this is awful. Isn't there anything? Anything? Anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Discorder magazine or check us out online at citr.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance?
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Hey everyone, this is Jordan, and you're listening to the All Access Pass on CITR 101.9 FM. I hope you are doing good and staying safe. We have an awesome show lined up for you today. But before we start, our fellow collective member Richard will be introducing our first song. Richard, take it away.
Thanks, Jordan, and hi everyone. The first song is called Say What You Will by Justin Hines from the album Chasing Silver.
You will. should have known? And how could I show? So say what you will before it's too late. Say what you will. Say what you will.
Welcome back to All Access Pass on CITR 101.9 FM. The song you just heard was Justin Hines' Say What You Will from the album Chasing Silver. Justin Hines is a Canadian singer-songwriter who was born in Newmarket, Ontario. Hines has a rare genetic joint condition called Larson's syndrome and uses a power wheelchair. He is a strong supporter of numerous charities and has performed at many fundraising events. He founded the Justin Hines Foundation, a charitable foundation for people with disabilities.
Thanks so much, Richard. Now, let's go to our show topic. Randy, Evan, and I had the pleasure of having a virtual sit-down with the editor-in-chief of the video game accessibility site, Dagger System. So without further ado, I would like to introduce Joshua Straub.
I'm Randy Millis from the Accessibility Collective, and I'm joined today by my colleague, Jordan. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning.
And we're honored this morning to also be joined by Josh Straub from Minneapolis and Evan Chang from Vancouver. Welcome, gentlemen.
Great to be here. Absolutely wonderful to be here.
So I guess we'll start out by asking Josh, if you don't mind, tell us a little bit about yourself. Who is Joshua Straub?
Well, I have had the privilege of working in the field of game accessibility now for the past 9 years. And I'm the editor-in-chief of a site called Dagger System. We're the web's premier resource for game reviews and retrospectives and perspectives on the area of video game accessibility for the physically disabled. So we review hardware, software, we write opinion pieces, and all with the goal of trying to turn physically disabled gamers into informed consumers so that they can purchase games that work for them. And then I'm also the chief consultant at Apex Access, which is a company that provides high-level accessibility consulting across the games industry. We've worked on games for as far back as Fortnite and as recent as Amazon's New World. So yeah, that's kind of me in a nutshell. I'm also a PhD student at the University of Minnesota in Human Factors. And, you know, it's just my privilege every day to wake up and help disabled gamers find games they can play, or help developers build games that disabled gamers can play without alienating their core able-bodied audience.
Excellent. So tell us a little bit about what it was like being raised in Minneapolis.
Well, I actually wasn't raised in the Apple. I was born in Edmonton, Alberta. I always say I'm American by birth, but Canadian by the grace of God. And I lived the first 10 years of my life in Windsor, Ontario. And then I moved down to Atlanta. And I've actually only been in Minneapolis for about the last 16 years. So I have bounced around all over. And, you know, what I can say with that kind of perspective, not to get too political, is I miss my universal healthcare, because being disabled and growing up in Canada, you had really good, really, really good services. And it's, you know, every place kind of had its own benefits, you know, the weather down in Atlanta or I can't think of a single thing I like about Minneapolis. There are many good things about Minneapolis, but there's no one thing that stands out. It's just a great city overall. But I sort of bounced around throughout my youth, mainly doing my dad's job as a professor, first finishing his PhD and then going to different institutions variously. I've kind of grown up all over North America.
Awesome. If you can tell me, I'm a non-gamer, so you'll have to excuse my lack of subject knowledge. But so, what is Dagger System? Is it just a website? Is there more to it than that? What can you tell us about it?
So it started out as just a website, and it's not overstating the fact that it really kind of started out as a personal blog. As I had a little bit of background in games journalism, and from that experience, I realized there was a dearth of resources in the industry for helping disabled people find games they could play. So I started this little website where it was just me reviewing games and hardware. From that grew out, the first step we took was we expanded our editorial staff. So currently we have an editorial staff of five right now that all write from various perspectives. And then after we expanded, we got the opportunity to open the consulting. And then most recently, we broke off the journalism into its own nonprofit and the consulting into its own for-profit company. And what that allowed us to do is what my dream was always to do, which was build the Accessible Games Database, which is a searchable database of games where you can say, these are the features I need, these are the hardware, this is the hardware I have, and get recommendations based on those criteria. And so Dagger System, when you ask what is Dagger System, we're really trying to make it a focal point for disabled gamers and developers to come find resources about accessibility and make the entire hobby more accessible.
So it sounds like quite an evolution.
Yes, absolutely.
And evolutionary-wise as well, I guess, what characteristics make a game accessible or not accessible that most of us wouldn't even think about?
You know, that's a really hard question to answer, especially from my perspective, because in the Dagger's philosophy has always been accessibility should support a developer's vision, not overrule it. So depending on the developer's vision, an accessible game will look different. And some developers, I would say, have the total right to say, we're not making an accessible game. So accessibility really needs to be handled on a game-to-game basis. The three principles that we use overarching when we talk about accessibility are the three F's: flexibility, forgiveness, and fun. Flexibility is just how much can I customize the experience to compensate for my physical limitations. the more flexible a game, the more accessible it usually is. Forgiveness is having a disability and gaming means that you will fail more often because of how your disability affects the act of interfacing with the game. And so the concept of forgiveness is, when I do fail, how much of the game do I have to retread to get back up to that failure point to try it again? And so if I'm playing old school Halo and dying necessitates me going back to a checkpoint I crossed 5-10 minutes ago, that's a less forgiving game than let's say a game like Ratchet & Clank Rift Apart, where I can attempt a jump sequence, and if I fail it, I just start right back up at the beginning of that jump sequence. So that's the idea of forgiveness. And then fun is real simple. The mantra we use around the office is, the only thing worse than a good game you can't play is a bad game you can, because nobody wants to play bad video games. So yeah.
Excellent answer. I think you touched on this a little bit, but one of the questions from the collective was, what led you to become the editor of Dagger System?
Believe it or not, it all started on a bet. I was wrapping up my career at Southwest Minnesota State for my undergrad, and I had an honors capstone course where the whole goal was to write a paper. And I was struggling to find the content, to find the topic for this course. And one day, about 2 weeks into the semester, my professor comes in and he just starts railing against video games, and in particularly against the use of avatars to represent people. You know, why are you making yourself look like a you know, spelt night elf when you're 40 years old, you know, have a beer belly and whatever, you know? And I said, and I took that as a challenge. And I said, Dr. Kramer, what you have to realize is that when people see me, they interact with me in a certain way. But if they see a character in a game, they don't have any preconceived assumptions. So games create this sort of meritocracy of performance where you're solely based on what you do. So that prompted me to, and my professor bet me, that I could not find documentation on the medical benefits of gaming for the disabled. So I did a paper on the medical benefits of gaming for the disabled, and that's what showed me the need for a resource like Dagger System. So I went and I interned at Game Informer magazine for a summer and kind of got a deeper understanding of the industry. And then I started my site basically just to keep my writing chops sharp while I applied for my master's, and it kind of snowballed from there. When I started it in 2012, I didn't really think I would end up running a site with a staff, even though we're all part-time, or that I would end up kind of working with the various clients like Epic and PlayStation that I've worked with over the years.
So your dream has really materialized, it sounds like.
Yeah, I would say that. I'm still not where I would like to be as far as I want to see more developers take game accessibility seriously. And without calling anybody specific out, there are a few companies that have come out and perpetuated untruths about how much it would cost to make games accessible. And there are other companies that, because they culturally originate in other countries with different values placed on persons with disabilities, they don't value people with disabilities, so they're not going to value making their games. So I wouldn't say my dreams has materialized. And so everybody, if you look at game accessibility and you say, you know, it doesn't support our mission, that's fine. But if you don't even look at it, my job's not done. My job is to show game developers that making game accessible can be done cheaply, can be done easily, and can be done at high impact. Not every game has to be The Last of Us Part Two. You can make the biggest impact with the smallest features sometimes. And that's what I'm trying to do. So that's when my dream will be fully realized. Is when all of the major hardware players look at accessibility and say, we value this. We want to include it in our game.
I just want to quickly jump in. You talked about your master's degree. I was just noticing, I was looking at through your LinkedIn, and you started Dagger Systems in 2012. And in that time period since then, you've got your master's degree and a doctorate in philosophy. Or can you expand on your academics?
Well, when I started consulting, I had the pleasure to work with a woman by the name of Celia Hoden, which is, if you're familiar with the field of game teacher research, she is the premier game teacher researcher. And she sat me down and she said, you really need, you know, you have a great perspective, you have a great voice, but you really need academic credentials to back up what you, to get the industry to respect you. So the funny thing is, I was, because I come from an academically intense household anyways, my brother has a master's, my dad has a PhD, I was already planning on going into some field for master's work. At that time, I was thinking actually about a medieval history master's, because my dad's a historian and I love history. Well, I actually failed my GRE because they failed to accommodate me appropriately. And so I ended up scoring really low on the GRE because they did not have the proper state mandated accommodations in place. So that forced me to wait 2 years on starting my degree. And by the time I had waited those 2 years, the consulting had started and people were like, you really need a degree in either human factors or human computer interaction. Well, the University of Minnesota happens to be one of the only PhD programs in human factors. And the way it works, because it's such a new program, is it was a hybrid program where I could do all the work for the master's and it would go directly into the PhD. So I'm actually, because of COVID and not being able to find personal care attendants, I've actually had to pause my PhD until the labor market gets better. But I'm what they call ABD, all but dissertation, which means I've finished my classwork and I'm just working on writing the paper. But if you don't have anyone to type for you, it's hard to write a two to 400 page dissertation. So yeah, did that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you so much.
All right, so we're just gonna jump into some questions about Dagger System now. So, this isn't exclusive to Dagger System. This could also go to your time in Game Informer and any other publication, but what would you say is the most memorable article that you've ever written? And can you describe it?
Well, I'll give you my favorite article, and I'll give you my most memorable article. My favorite article that I ever wrote, we were, the interns at Game Informer were in charge of covering the news feed. So we would write half a dozen articles a day that were 200 to 500 words on various news happenings throughout the industry. Well, one day, somebody at CNN was doing a story on the UN Security Council, the UNSC. But somebody didn't do the research. And so instead of putting the UNSC graphic up on the news broadcast, it was the UNSC logo from Halo. So it was this whole debacle. And that was my favorite article I wrote for Game Informer. The most memorable article, I got the opportunity. I was the first intern they ever put in print. And so in the October of 2012 issue of Game Informer, I wrote the op-ed for that month on game accessibility, what it is and why it matters. And that really became the impetus for the work that I do today. So that's kind of your 2-for-1 answer.
Those are both great answers. And yeah, wow, it really kind of set the tone for the rest of your career. That's amazing.
That was Accessibility Collective member Jordan with Joshua Straub, editor of Dagger Systems, talking about accessibility within the gaming industry. Up next is our second song, Wonder, by Natalie Merchant, from her album Tiger Lily.
To see me stand over my bed, disbelieving what they see. Thank you.
Welcome back to All Access Pass on CITR 101.9 FM. The song you just heard was Wonder by Natalie Merchant from her album Tiger Lily. A little bit about Natalie. When she was a teenager, Natalie Merchant worked at a day camp for special needs children, many of whom had been institutionalized since infancy and abandoned by their parents. This song was inspired by her experience.
Thanks, Evan. Now let's get back to our show topic.
Tell us a little bit more about this disability renaissance that you've been speaking of.
Well, let's put it in this terms. When I started Dagger System, we decided to give a Game of the Year award out, and we gave it out. It's called our Dagger's Diamond Award. We gave it out to the original Last of Us, and the only reason we gave it to them was because it was a game that I could complete with no help from an able-bodied person. That was the standard back then. Well, fast forward 11 years, you have The Last of Us Part 2, which has 75 different discrete accessibility features. You have a massive explosion in resources for the disabled, whether it's gameaccessibilityguidelines.com, which is focused on guidelines for developers, or Can I Play That, or Dagger System, or the Able Gamers Foundation. You have all, whereas when I started, it was literally just me and the Able Gamers Foundation, and then one switch out of England. That number of advocacy groups and tools for developers has just exploded over the last 10 years, 9 years, right now.
I see. So it's it really started at the point where it was just kind of the bare minimum with games, just like the bare minimum was a game having accessibility. And now
the bare minimum used to be the game being playable.
Oh, no.
And now a game that is simply playable is not good enough. You have to have some consideration for accessibility. And not to toot my own horn too much, but it's been my privilege. I was the one that helped Naughty Dog build the accessibility suite that eventually I started back with Uncharted 4, and eventually we put into place the system that would become The Last of Us Part 2 accessibility. I took Insomniac, or rather my team took Insomniac, from having almost no knowledge about accessibility to now having an industry-leading set of features in Ratchet and Clank Rift Apart. So it's been an incredible blessing to kind of be at the forefront of the wave as the momentum behind accessibility builds. And you know, I have so many people, my parents, you know, my various friends who helped me over the years that have all kind of pushed me and helped me along, that I just, you know, it's been a wild ride. But yeah, it's kind of been like sitting on top of a tsunami as it builds and builds and builds. And there's no end in sight at this point.
Yeah, that's amazing. Especially, wow, being a part of with The Last of Us Part 2, like their suite of accessibility options is crazy. So you and your team, that's very commendable. Congratulations.
And let me make this clear. We were not the only team in. There were Brandon Cole, Paul Wayne, so many. And that's the other thing that we've seen a massive expansion in the last 9 years is the number of competent and passionate game accessibility professionals, even if they don't have the academic background. I mean, Paul Lane, who you may not be familiar with, is the ABC station chief for the ABC radio station in LA, and he does game accessibility as a side gig. He's there because he's a quadriplegic. He's the kind of guy. He's been in the trenches. He's worked with accessibility for years and years, and now we're seeing really, really, serious strides.
Amazing. Okay. So, to my next question, just because I we're on the topic of you actually working with the studios as well as all these other individuals working with the studios to make or to implement accessibility options. What studios have you worked with, and who have you partnered with?
So I've partnered with Amazon, with Santa Monica Studios, with God of War, with Naughty Dog, with Insomniac, with Epic, with a couple different teams out of Ubisoft. Pretty much, last time I checked, I had 16 different titles I had worked on, and most of them were AAA. But they're primarily out of the Sony stable of games.
I see. So no one from Microsoft has talked to you about getting some accessibility options in Halo Infinite, hey?
Oh, they are. I didn't say that. Just keep in mind, there are things called non-disclosure.
Fair enough.
But I will say I do know the accessibility team at Microsoft, and they're the kind of company that is more apt to do things in-house than to hire third-party consultants. So they have some top five people over there. They have some absolutely top five people over there, but because of the way they work, they don't really need
outsourcing
as many outsourced consultants.
I see. Fair enough. Okay, and to my next question. So with the studios you've worked for, obviously games are very expensive to make these days. So say we have a AAA game, if a studio wants to add accessibility options, how much more does it cost within a studio's budget to implement those? Or is there any cost at all?
The cost is usually, no, I can't. Because again, I'm an independent consultant, so I don't get to look at the plus minuses on the various initiatives. But I can tell you that the cost usually is in the initial setup. So I have been told by a reliable source that compared to what you and I would assume it was. The actual cost for The Last of Us Part II accessibility was much cheaper because they already had the systems in place from Uncharted Lost Legacy and Uncharted 4. And so, again, another mantra we use around the office is that if accessibility is too expensive, you're doing it wrong. Because so much impact can be done with the tools that developers already have access to. So much accessibility can be accomplished in that way that the opportunity cost for a minimum standard is really kind of low. So every major game development engine has the ability to include fully remappable controls. Yes, it takes work, but it's literally a matter of flipping a switch and then making sure it integrates into your game well. It's not like you have to design the system from scratch. So the price, while I can't put a number on the price, I can say it is lower than it looks like to outsiders.
Awesome. I just have a question about some features in games that maybe you've worked on or you play. What are some features that you would want to see more readily implemented into the games?
So when I was asked to work on Ratchet and Clank Rift Apart, they caught me completely by surprise with their game speed filter. Because game speed is a feature. I'm sorry, let me restate that. When I was asked to work on Ratchet and Clank Rift Apart, they caught me completely by surprise due to the implementation of their game speed feature. Mainly because that used to be a feature in games way back in the day. One of the very earliest attempts at making a game accessible was back in the 70s when an engineer took a Pong cabinet apart and made it so that you could manually set the speed of the opposing pong paddle. And so from there, for me to come in and I had virtually no input on that feature. That feature was in place by the time I came in. I want every game to have that feature, to have the ability to slow down. That is a feature that should be industry-wide. I don't care if you're a racing game, if you're an RPG, game speed controls should be the standard.
I just have a follow-up on that. When it comes to like game speed, does it ruin the immersion, or is there, like, how does that flow with the game?
Well, let me answer your question by asking you a question. Does it, what ruins the game more? Changing the speed or not being able to play it? See, that's what people don't realize. These features are optional for people who don't need them, but for people who do need them, in many cases, they're not optional. So it's not like a player who needs it will say, well, I don't like it because it ruins the immersion. They'll say thank you because now I can play this game that otherwise I couldn't play.
Right. Thank you. Awesome. So what games have you played or that you've worked with that have checked almost all the boxes on an accessibility approachable standpoint?
So there is one industry standard, and it doesn't matter who you ask, they'll all say the same thing. There is one industry standard, and that is The Last of Us Part Two. That's not a perfect game, and it doesn't have perfect accessibility, but it is the most comprehensive suite of accessibility features. But like I said, the whole process is iterative. So now, even though Ratchet and Clank has maybe two-thirds or slightly fewer features, because they have this new game speed feature, they're a pioneer in some ways that Last of Us Part Two isn't. But as far as games that check all the boxes or almost all the boxes, there's only one answer, and that's Last of Us Part Two.
So on the flip side then, what game, in your opinion, has had the worst suite of accessibility options?
Oh boy, how do I want to answer this? Yeah, I'm just going to be honest with you. Basically, anything first-party Nintendo. So Metroid Dread, Animal Crossing. And that's just because those studios don't offer a lot of settings to begin with. So if they don't have settings to begin with, they're not going to have accessibility settings. And that goes, we could go into various things, but that goes into the company culture and the culture of it being a Japanese culture. But basically, from what I have read, Japan is a couple decades at least behind the U.S. in terms of disability services. And so that comes out in Nintendo's game design. And I love Nintendo games. I love Nintendo as a company. I've often said that the person who is able to help Nintendo make more games accessible will be the person who, quote unquote, solves game accessibility. Because they're one of the big boys and they've got virtually nothing in place. Right. I mean Metroid Dread was literally the least accessible game I have ever reviewed on the site without any hyperbole or anything.
It's really interesting, actually, just because when I'm not the biggest Nintendo kind of fan at the end of the day, but I had a Wii when I was a kid, and the aim of that console was to be something that everyone could play. And I'm surprised, especially like even today with their Switch, like, wow, I didn't know that it was that bad still.
Oh yeah. But again, it's not a malicious intent on Nintendo's, that's not what I'm saying. But because those studios don't put in basic things like volume controls or brightness and gamma or difficulty options, they're not going to have control room mapping or game speed controls or even subtitles in some cases.
Regarding your accessibility game database, can you tell us a little bit about it and what prompted you to create it in the first place?
Sure. Well, originally, DAGGERS was an acronym for Disabled Accessibility Gaming Entertainment Rating System. And so even at the very beginning, I had this concept of a searchable tool like the ESRB where players could put in their needs and get recommendations out of it. And so that's basically what the Accessible Games Database is. We send out surveys to developers about what accessibility features they have in their games, and then we put that data directly into the database. So that a player can go in and say, I am red green colorblind, I have an Xbox Series X, and I need remappable sticks. And then it'll take all those criteria and it'll give you a list of recommendations.
I see, I understand. Now, when you review a game, I see that you've got a rating scale. What differentiates a game with good accessibility options from a great one?
So, the way we do it at DAGGERS is not based on the number of features when we give a rating. It's based on how much of the game could I play without the help of an able-bodied person. So when we assign a rating, we're not necessarily looking at the number of features, because there can be features like games. I know I just ripped into Nintendo, but there can be features like games like Animal Crossing New Horizons that are still very accessible because of the core nature of the game. So we're not so much, when we give a rating, we're not so much looking at the number of features as we are how much of the game could I play and enjoy without the help of somebody who does not have my impairment.
Right. Do you think overall, I mean, certainly we've touched on this, but I mean, more specifically, do you think that overall games are becoming more and more accessible?
The short answer is yes. The slightly longer answer is yes, but there are still a few studios and even some larger companies who very obviously don't value accessibility, and they're not all internationally based. There are some homegrown studios who have said erroneous things about the cost of accessibility, and there are some. And on the flip side of that, I am in almost weekly contact with small indie studios saying, you know, we want to put our games in the AGD, or we want you to, you know, do you have an indie rate for smaller studios, you know? And so there are big companies who don't want to do it, and there are small companies that do. But on the whole, the trend is upwards. We're getting closer and closer to a future where everyone can play.
That's amazing. That's incredible. Mm-hmm. These days, we tend to see a lot of games that have become a lot more complicated within their scope and gameplay complexity. How would you suggest studios balance this when they're creating games?
Could you elaborate on that a bit?
I can elaborate a bit. Especially like these days, I kind of bring in like multiplayer games or even kind of role-playing games. A lot more games these days are very complex, and that you have a lot of subsystems, you have a lot of menus. It's not just, say, compared to Halo to Destiny, it's not just shoot a bad guy, pick up a weapon. Now it's shoot a bad guy, go through a menu, do a puzzle, do all of these different things. So especially like since accessibility is a lot more in the forefront these days, how would a developer balance this when making their game and maybe adjusting how complex their game is?
I don't necessarily think complexity affects accessibility. I'm sorry to beat a dead horse, but I mean, Last of Us Part 2 can be a very controlled complex game, depending on how you want to play it. Or Spider-Man, another great example is Spider-Man Miles Morales, can be a very controlled complex game. But what the thing that makes those games accessible is that the developer has included options. So in Miles Morales, there's what is known in the industry as a chase rubber banding feature, which allows you to basically say that the villains, when you're doing a chase sequence, will never get away. They'll always stay within a certain distance of you, so that even if you're struggling with the intricacies of the web swinging mechanic, you will eventually accomplish what the goal of that chase sequence is. So the way you compensate for complexity is not by eliminating it. The way you compensate for it is by designing around it, providing options, providing alternate pathways to complete puzzles or making the inaccessible portions of a game less optional, making them more optional. Let me restate that. The way you make a game accessible is not by reducing complexity, it's by designing around the complexity. So this can be making games that where the puzzles that are fine motor intensive are not mandatory, or making games that have customizable controls, or anything that makes the game more flexible, makes it more accessible.
So just as a follow-up to that too, because just kind of like popping off it, the two games you mentioned though are single player games. So how would you balance that and say a multiplayer game like Halo? I always bring this example up because I play a lot of Halo. So I'm just kind of thinking about like that game is very specific and everybody has to be on an equal playing field. So you can't.
Exactly.
Yeah. So if you could maybe help me understand, how would you put in a feature like a game speed option, in a game where everyone needs to have like the same type of level of auto aim or the same.
That's why I say that the developer's vision has to come first, otherwise the experience gets skewed. So there will always be a game by definition includes challenge. And the nature of challenge is that not everybody will be able to complete it. So I reject the idea that a game can be designed for everyone to play. If a game is designed for everyone to play, that means that you have to rip out all the challenge and then it is no longer a game. It is simply an interactive story. So there has to be a line you draw somewhere. And so, for example, my 80-year-old grandmother would not be able to play Ratchet & Clank Rift Apart. And that means Ratchet & Clank Rift Apart isn't an accessible game or a bad game. It just means it wasn't designed for 86-year-olds, you know. So we all have limitations, and one of the troubling trends that I see in the messaging within the industry is this kind of everyone plays mentality. Yes, it's a nice slogan, but it's not really a viable approach. You have to figure out what limitations you impose on the player to give them a challenge to make it a game. And then you have to work backwards from there. There's a distinction in accessibility between overt and hidden barriers. Overt barriers are the barriers that somebody signs up for when they purchase a game. So in other words, Guitar Hero. I would never say that Guitar Hero is an inaccessible game for the hearing impaired, because the nature of Guitar Hero is that in order to get the full experience, it's best to be able to hear. That is inherent to the nature of it. A hidden barrier is what we try to address at Dagger System. That's something that is not clear in the game's very nature or in its marketing. And it's something like lacking a save anywhere function, like we see in Far Cry 6, or, you know, lacking proper control customization, like in Metroid Dread. Those are things that the player won't know to look for until they boot up the game. Well, with digital rights management the way that it is, game studios have to protect their cash flow, so they have to make it so the games can't be easily pirated. But that means that a lot of times players don't know whether they can play a game until they bought it, and then there are a lot, especially when you're dealing with a fixed income population like players with disabilities.
That was Joshua Straub, editor of Dagger System on accessibility within the gaming industry.
Up next, we have another song for you guys.
The third song is called Watching by X-Ari.
Show up in a black cat, tight jeans, silver lake cowboy, kinda like it, all alone in the corner of my eye. My friends talking, but I cannot focus on anything else since I've noticed you around, and I'm down, but I'm feeling shy. 10 feet away, but you're so far. I'm dying to know just who you are. You look at me, I'm staring. What's your name? Where you're from? What's a tattoo? Do you got a girlfriend or could you be mine? Couple drinks trying to build up the courage, but the lump in my throat got me nervous. I'm just hoping that I don't run out of time. 10 feet away, but you're so far. I'm dying to know just who you are. You look at me, I'm staring back at ya. And I'm watching, watching. You watch me watching. And someone's about to make a move. And I'm hoping that it's gonna be you. And I'm watching, watching. You watching me watching. And someone's about to make a move. And I'm hoping that it's gonna be you. Ooh, ooh. You. You.
Welcome back to All Access Pass on CITR 101.9 FM. The song you just heard was Watching by X-Ari, off her album As You Are. X-Ari is a singer-songwriter, artist, and mental health advocate from Toronto. Her motto is to turn pain into power through using music as a catharsis to channel pain into something meaningful and artful. Struggling with anxiety, depression, PTSD, insomnia, and ADHD herself, she hopes that through her projects, she can help others with self-acceptance and break the stigma attached to mental health.
Thanks, Richard. Now, let's get back to our interview.
As a site dedicated to supporting disability issues, how do you make the site itself accessible?
You know, I have a small background, so after I went to Game Informer, I did a very small, short stint at a web accessibility firm. And so I take what I learned from there and I try to make sure it's implemented every day. And then on top of that, whenever we hire web designers, we make sure that one of the first things they tackle, or in some cases, one of the last things they tackle before they turn the keys over on, say, a new version of the AGD, is the WCAG and other forms of accessibility. So the short answer there is we have a short list of best practices that we implement in-house, but the lion's share of the accessibility we outsource to more competent people in that area.
Thank you very much.
So compared to other review sites, what would you say they are missing in regarding addressing accessibility? And what are you doing that they aren't in it or they can't? And how do you guys differentiate yourself?
So I'll answer this question in two parts. First, I'll talk about mainstream press, and then I'll talk about disability press. The bottom line is the mainstream press is just not going to be able to handle accessibility. They don't have disabled writers on staff, many of them, or what I would call profoundly disabled writers who write from a platform of knowledge. They don't have systems in place to evaluate because it's really outside their purview. So really, the mainstream is lacking almost any degree of accessibility. You know, the best we can hope for is that when one of the smaller advocates like myself or people over at Cannot Play That are able to throw up an op-ed on Game Informer or IGN. Then on the other side, I'm seeing a really troubling weakness in the accessibility press, where there's a sense of sort of toxic entitlement. So one of the cornerstone example of this was Sekiro Shadows Die Twice. They were very upfront about this being a Souls-like game. They were very upfront about this being a punishingly difficult game, and they got ripped apart by the various disability advocates for not including this. For not including difficulty settings. And that to me is really unfortunate because they were honest up front. They had a vision that did not allow for that accessibility feature. And I think that that's their right. I think that we run the risk of pushing diversity out of the game design space if we insist that every game has to tick certain boxes accessibility-wise. And I don't think anger and vinegar on social media accomplishes anything. And so one of the things that we do at Daggers is that we say we are educators, we are not advocates, because advocates have an agenda. We're not here to say whether a game is good or bad. We're just here to say whether it's accessible or not. And other sites will attach morality to accessibility, which I hope something we never do. Another weakness that I see specifically in the accessibility press is there are a few very, very competent, top-notch people out there, people like Grant Stoner, people again like Paul Lynch, who are full-time journalists and professionals. But from what I see, in a lot of these big bigger accessibility publications, they just let anybody with a disability write for them. And I hate to tell you this, but just being a disabled gamer does not qualify you to write on game accessibility. We, like, so at Daggers, we have an intensive vetting and training process for our writers. We will work with anybody who says they want to work with us, but they have to go through our system first, because we want to make sure that when they publish an article, and to be honest, we are such a small team that plenty of errors probably slip through on a regular basis. But we still have systems in place where when we catch those errors, we address them immediately, we publish addendums, and we make it public. Whereas what we're seeing from other sites is you see articles that are full of clerical errors, spelling errors, they're full of emotional language, they're more the writer's opinion than based on scientific fact, you know, and so the shortcoming in the existing space is that there's too much emotion, there's too much anger, and there's a lack of training. If I could boil it down into those three challenges.
Very concise and descriptive answer. Thank you. So I also wanted to ask, for Dagger System, how do you get funding for your nonprofit?
So it is a cornerstone of Dagger System that we never want to go to our end user for funding. You should not have to choose between supporting us and buying a game you can play. So our strategy is what I call whale hunting. So our very first donation was from Naughty Dog Studios, and we're hoping to end up as an industry supported nonprofit rather than a consumer reported nonprofit, because too many of our consumers are on limited incomes, and too many of our consumers don't have the upward mobility. And I've said this in board meetings, and I'll say it here today. I would rather this entire endeavor implode than take a single dollar from a disabled person on a fixed income, because the whole reason I started Daggers, I was blessed enough to come from a family with a little bit more financial wherewithal. We're not rich, but we are comfortable. And what that allowed me to do was that allowed me to take the risk when I was first starting out with Daggers and buy all these games for review and lose money when I traded them back into GameStop. Because I can afford to take that risk. Other disabled gamers can't. And so it's so critical for me when looking for funding that we are an industry-supported nonprofit. Now, if there's a disabled billionaire out there, please understand, I will take your money, but we're not looking for money from the community itself, because the community is fixed income.
Excellent and very noble. My partner has mild cerebral palsy, and she suffers from random muscle spasms. How does that impact players, and is there any way to mitigate that? And if you have any personal stories you could relate to that, or any stories about others that are relatable, I wonder if maybe you could touch on that briefly.
So without meeting her, I couldn't give you a one-to-one solution. But what I can say is when you're looking at accessibility, you don't necessarily look at the impairment, you look at how the impairment affects the experience. So random muscle spasms will result in random inputs on the controller. And random inputs are something we have a long history of dealing with. And what that boils down to accessibility-wise is making sure that players aren't punished for those random inputs, or they're not punished if their body rebels and they miss a timing cue on a QTE. So, what was the second half of your question?
I just wondered if there's any way that you can mitigate those sort of things.
Right.
And then I wondered if you had any stories that might be relatable to that kind of that line of thinking.
So perfect example. One of great example was at the end of Uncharted for, I think that one was some kind of Among Thieves, it doesn't matter. But at the end of Uncharted 4, there was a list of kind of goofy filters that you could put on a game that were like big head filter or you know, all the enemies had shotguns or various kind of gimmicky ways to affect the gameplay. One of the filters they ended up putting in was something called Thief Vision, which made your character blue and all the good characters blue and all the bad characters red. Well, what they meant as kind of a gimmick ended up being kind of a hidden gem of an accessibility feature, because if you're low vision, that's a de facto high contrast mode. So there's all kinds of stories about bespoke accessibility just kind of happening. So one of the ones that I use in my own personal life was I obviously have a great love for history, and I love the Assassin's Creed games. Well, it's been really unfortunate in the past few generations of Assassin's Creed games that they've gotten rid of the stealth-based multiplayer, because that was a multiplayer experience that did not rely on timing, that did not rely on skill shots, that was not accuracy-based, but it focused on planning and execution and knowledge of the map, and it was this really, really great experience that now we no longer have access to, that was this wildly accessible kind of ancillary experience to the main Assassin's Creed game.
Great, I appreciate that answer.
We've been talking a lot about in-game accessibility and just the pushes towards working on the game itself and different options to enable the game to be more playable within the community. I was just wondering about add-ons and different accessories you can use outside of the games and your opinion on them.
So there are great accessories you can use, like the Xbox accessible controller. But that's not really my area of expertise. My attitude when running Dagger System is that if you're coming to my site, you already have a hardware setup that's accessible for you. So I never really focused on hardware. That said, I am aware of all the great work Microsoft is doing, and I wish I could give you a more definite answer, but I've always just been more focused on the software side of things. Mm-hmm.
I kind of want to switch to a more prospective look at the gaming industry and accessibility in general. I'm just thinking, within your career in the industry, what are some things that have enabled like more control and that you're able to achieve now with like advancements in technology and stuff, as opposed to when you first started out?
Years ago, there was less accessibility, and that came down, and that was due in part because there was less accessibility in the engines that were building the games. So because of, I mentioned Dr. Celia Hoden previously in the interview, because of the work she did, because of the work others at Epic did, great improvement in the number of baked-in accessibility features within the Epic Games engine. And we see that all across the industry, is that more and more engines are coming with pre-built accessibility features, which allows these smaller studios who are just using these out-of-the-box engines to include more in the area of accessibility.
I think adding on to that, there's kind of been a shift towards AR, like augmented reality and virtual reality technologies and games built around those platforms. Is there a conversation on that currently, or are you been working on anything like that? Or
well, I was a hair's breadth away from doing my dissertation on accessibility in VR. Wow. And what stopped me was that they're still too far away from widespread adoption. Mm-hmm. accessibility has to come after your platform is stable. And the Oculus fans out there may disagree with me, but VR is not a widespread adopted technology yet.
Right.
It's still a niche technology. And one of my advisors his main field is VR. And he told me something that blew my mind, and that is motion sickness in VR affects women at a much higher rate than it affects men. And so if that's the case, VR has more critical problems to address before they can get to accessibility. Accessibility has to come once all the technical things are worn down. Otherwise, you end up with a broken game with accessibility features, which we have seen in the past, and it doesn't help the overall experience.
Josh, I was wondering, what are some of your other hobbies besides gaming? Hobbies, activities, that sort of thing. What do you do when you're not behind a game console or?
I'm an avid reader. I try to read 36 books a year. I read all class, everything from sci-fi and fantasy, everything classic. I've also made a sort of a hobbyist study of Winston Churchill. So I try to read one book on Churchill every year. And then I also am big into other forms of gaming. Before the lockdown came, I was a fairly regular competitor at local Magic the Gathering tournaments. And I also play, since the lockdown, I've gotten really into online D&D. So I guess you could say I'm the total package nerd in some ways. But yeah, those are my main hobbies.
Wow, that's a lot of reading. Very impressive.
36
I guess... sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to comment, like, 36 books is unfathomable to me.
That's a book every 10 days about.
Wow.
Jesus.
That's crazy to me.
Well, it's easy to do when you're doing audiobooks.
I guess in closing, finally, Josh, is there anything that you would like to leave our CITR listeners with? Any final thoughts?
Well, I hope that your listeners will come check out the website, check out the AGD, AccessibleGamesDatabase.com. Please give us feedback. Reach out to me on Twitter, either directly at Josh P. Straub or through the company Twitter Dagger System. I don't use my personal Twitter much, but I do keep an eye on it for messages that come in. And then thank you for your support. I mean, even if you never interact, if you come to my website once, I consider you a supporter. And it's just been so great to work with the many hundreds of and thousands of people in the disabled gaming community who have reached out. And I just want to say thank you for the opportunity of the interview. And, you know, thank you for this, just caring enough to put a segment together on the needs of disabled gamers.
And thank you very much for joining us today and for all of your insightful responses.
Oh, my pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for coming out.
It's really amazing hearing just all this, like, real experience, and especially your extremely extensive academic background. It's always a pleasure to hear someone so passionate about what they do, and I'm really honored to be a part of this interview with you.
Oh, thank you. It really was my pleasure.
There you have it, a very insightful look into how accessibility and the video game industry converge. I would like to sincerely thank Joshua for coming on the show. It was a pleasure. Up next, here's Avery, who looked into how the media views the gaming industry in terms of accessibility in the form of a pros and cons analysis. Avery, take it away.
All right. Hi, everyone. So my report is going to mainly be about social media and how each social media platform has worked to incorporate accessibility features or still needs to improve the sites to make them more accessible. And then I'm going to touch on video games at the end as well. I'm focusing on a study done by Queen's University about each platform and the features they have in place or what they are lacking. So starting off with Instagram, this platform is photo and video based, making it challenging for people with visual disabilities to utilize the app. A step to combat this is when uploading a photo to the app, you can add Instagram's alternative text feature to your post by tapping next and then advanced settings and filling in the alt text box to describe what is in the post. Moving on to Snapchat, this app is even less accessible than Instagram, unfortunately, given that the photos and videos sent to you can only be played once for a few seconds before they disappear, and stories disappear after 24 hours. Something that can be done is uploading longer videos to YouTube, which has a closed captioning and transcript feature, making it one of the more accessible platforms. If Snapchat must be used, you can set the text setting to the largest, most legible font and just make sure the photo is clear. Lastly, I'll be discussing Twitter. Some issues with Twitter is that on the actual site, there's no accessibility hot link that links the resources available. And upon registering for the app, it prompts you to complete a CAPTCHA system lock, which is photo-based, and the link for the audio option is quite small. So a tip for the actual tweets is when composing a tweet, you can put the associated hashtags or at mentions at the end of the tweet, making it easier for the reader to identify the main points. Also, using uppercase letters by capitalizing the first letter of each compound word makes it stand out more visually to the reader. There's a more accessible alternative to Twitter, actually. It's an app called Chirp that is worth checking out too. As of right now, Twitter is obviously has more downloads than Chirp, but hopefully that can change soon. So kind of ending this off with a discussion about video games. Obviously, some of the pros in engaging with video games is that it boosts creativity, problem-solving skills, and online communication. However, these advantages are usually not accessible. Usually not accessible for people with visual, cognitive, physical, or auditory disabilities. So after some research I did, though, I found a ton of websites that curate games which have been specifically designed in accessible formats for everyone. Some of those websites are called Ability Powered, The Controller Project, Level Access, Special Effect, and more. So I hope you learned a thing or two about the gaming and media world's accessibleness and that these resources can help you make your personal social media pages more user-friendly. It's something that we use and interact with every day, so it's really important that everybody is able to access them. So now here's Gura with his report on how accessibility issues can be dealt with.
Thank you so much, Avery. Again, as you said, it's so important that graphics design and UI design, it's so important that these elements are also catered to individuals with disabilities. So in my report on how accessibility issues can be dealt with, I'm going to explain a little bit about esports and sports in regular and the sort of disability and accessibility topics we can learn by comparing the two. The movement towards accessibility enamored the sports world as Sir Ludwig Gutmann developed the Paralympics as an organized sports competition for British World War II veterans with spinal cord injuries. In parallel, we see how the accessibility movement and the issues those that are disabled face heads towards a new frontier, esports. Esports is competitive video game playing, a worldwide phenomenon that grosses billions per year and caters to millions of viewers. As esports has evolved from its origins in 1972, from game to game, the same accessibility questions that we ask in physical sports and in general can be brought up once again. How do we provide the same access to disabled individuals as those without disabilities in a competitive playing field? One esports body, the British Esports Association, the BEA, calls for gaming tournaments to be held that cater exclusively to players with disabilities, just like the Paralympics, to those that are disabled. This organization intends to work closely with conglomerates such as Microsoft to create a pilot competition in which disabled individuals can face off against one another in competitive esports gaming. Adaptive technology, such as the Xbox Adaptive Controller released in 2018, is still novel and the first of its kind in this field, but has already shown great progress in helping those with disabilities, such as muscular dystrophy and Parkinson's, play games. As with esports, we see that accessibility issues are dealt through innovation and conversation with those that have these accessibility issues. Companies such as Microsoft work with disabled individuals, hear their feedback, and cater options such as the adaptive controller to ease their burden in playing. There's a long way to go, but in a time where accessibility and inclusion is being represented at the corporate level, there is hope for speedy progress. Thank you.
Thanks so very much, Avery and Guru. And that wraps up our episode for today. Hope you all enjoyed.
If you're interested in joining our team or think there's an issue we should bring up on our show, please send us an email at accessibilitycollective@citr.ca.
A special thanks goes to Joshua Straub, the editor of Dagger System.
And please like our All Access Facebook page.
If you're on Twitter, Instagram, or both, please follow us at @access_CITR.
If you missed a part of our live show today and want to listen again, or maybe you just want to listen to our past shows, you can do so on CITR.ca by going into the search box and typing in All Access Pass.
Thank you for listening, and stick around for more CITR programming coming up next. Goodbye, everyone.
Вы настроены на FM 101.9 CITR. Радио Большого Ванкувера.